from KUT and KUTX Studios.
Thanks for joining us for this Views and Brews podcast, recorded live at the Cactus Cafe in Austin, Texas. We hope you enjoy the show.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Cactus Cafe. It's wonderful to have you all here. And I'm so glad you heard about it, because I thought the pledge drive at KUT might have drowned out all of our promos. So I'm so grateful that you all made it and came out to celebrate the rise and fall of Paramount Records. Okay, so I got to take a deep breath, because tonight we're starting with a poem. And I'm actually going to read the whole thing, and I'm not that great at this. So here's a poem to start tonight. It is a few reflections, brief reflections on maps by the Czech poet Miroslav Holub. Albert St. Georgi, who knew a few things about maps, by which life moves somewhere or other, used to tell this story from the war, through which history moves somewhere or other. From a small Hungarian unit in the Alps, a young lieutenant sent out a scouting party into the icy wastes. At once it began to snow. It snowed for 2 days, and the party did not return. The lieutenant was in distress. He had sent his men to their deaths. On the third day, however, the scouting party was back. Where had they been? How had they managed to find their way? Yes, the men exclaimed. We certainly did. We thought we were lost and awaited our end. When suddenly one of our lot found a map in his pocket, we felt reassured. We made a bivouac, waited for the snow to stop, and then with the map found the right direction. And here we are. The lieutenant asked to see the remarkable map in order to study it. It wasn't a map of the Alps, but the Pyrenees. Goodbye. In this poem, all the soldiers needed was a map. Not the map of the Alps where they were, but any map to locate them. Maps orient us and connect us to the land, to the past, to other people, to the living. Tonight we'll talk about the maps that music and recordings construct. The way music helps to link us to history, to mythology, to the voices that help us navigate our lives. And how accurate do our maps need to be to help us make sense of where we are today? Here with me to discuss music, authenticity, memory, sound, and the power of the human voice, co-founder of Revenant Records and lawyer, Dean Blackwood. Welcome. Also, along with Dean, and author of We Agree to Meet Just Here, See How Small, and co-producer, along with Dean and Jack White, of The Rise and Fall of Paramount Records, Volume 1 and 2, Scott Blackwood, welcome. So, Dean, about 3 years ago, you came into the KUT studios with one of these wonderful wooden boxes. And you did a recording, I believe it was with Terry Gross on Fresh Air, or somebody on NPR. And afterward, you stuck around with David Alvarez and I and went over all of the amazing material inside of this box and completely captivated me about the stories of Paramount Records. And I said, we have got to do a Views and Brews on this. So 3 years later, here we are, finally doing a Views and Brews on Paramount Records. Stick-to-itiveness. But I'd like you to start by kind of just, you know, telling us a little bit about the story of Paramount Records and how you got involved in putting this together.
Sure. So it was about 3.5 years ago. I had pretty much, you know, Revenant is sort of a labor of love record label that I've been running for about the last 20 years. And there was about a five-year period where I just didn't feel passionate enough about a particular subject to embark on one of these projects. They tend to take a long time to put together. We don't really have any employees, and so without the benefit of being able to latch on to someone else to really deal with all the, you know, marketing and selling, it felt a little bit deflating to embark on something. And so I didn't really have any plans to put anything out. I had a mutual friend with the musician Jack White, and I knew he had started a record label in Nashville. And And we arranged a meeting, and I originally came to him with the idea that, hey, this might be a project you might be interested in putting out. Maybe I could help with designing it or be of some other service to the project. And because I really came to it through a sort of design lens, as we had taken on more and more elaborate projects over the years, I'd become more interested in the designed object, you know, something that's a little bit more immersive, kind of a curated experience that would bring together, you know, it's not anti-technology by any stretch, but it would sort of bring together the old and the new, you know, where the old thing is best, where the hardbound book is still the best way to consume information, you still wanted to use that, but where, for example, you wanted to digest a huge amount of material, say 1,600 songs, would make more sense to deal in the digital realm, maybe have some sort of interface where consumers could engage with this stuff in an intuitive way. And so with that as a plan, I had brought with me just a timeline of this curious label called Paramount. So Paramount was around from 1917 to 1932. It was really started in the belly of this Wisconsin chair company, which was a furniture company. They weren't really interested in music. Like a lot of the labels at the time, they were interested in making a profit one way or another. They did some contract manufacturing for Thomas Edison when his plant burned down. That's how they learned how to make these somewhat elaborate phonograph cabinets. And the records themselves were really just an afterthought. They said, hey, we should put out our own versions of these phonograph cabinets. Oh, and we ought to put out some records also. People need something to play on these polished wonders. And you know, what they came to was they should do it as cheaply and as expediently as possible. So they had not a care in the world about quality. It was like a lot of technological evolutions that you see where first it's about the technology. You know, when it comes out, everybody's excited about the technology, but it doesn't take very long till it's about the content. What are you able to view? What are you able to do? What are you able to listen to through the technology? Well, they failed to appreciate that, and so they spent the first 5 years, you know, steadily going out of business. And what happened was, in 1922, they took what was then a bold step, which was they embarked on something called Race Records. There was a nascent industry that had started in 1920, and that was marketing the music of black performers to black audiences. Prior to that date, they hadn't really. The major record labels that were in business were largely marketing to white audiences. Even the black performers were of the more European choral traditions, more like Paul Robeson style singing. So they were being marketed to white audiences. And this was, it seems strange to us now, but this is the first time this had been identified as a viable market to sell to. And suddenly it exploded, and Paramount in 1922 got into the game, and due to a combination of luck, dumb luck, and partly due to their cheapness and their, you know, desire for expediency, they put very few filters on what they recorded. Whereas other labels of the time had, you know, would require, for example, test pressings and things before they would send somebody on a train to go and record. Paramount said, well, we have no idea what black people are interested in listening to, so we'll try anything. And that really enabled them to catch the lion's share of these great performers and this, you know, bedrock American music that they, precisely because they didn't understand how they should filter it for commercial consumption. They didn't understand their audience well enough to do that, all to our benefit now. And so the Paramount story is this embarrassment of riches. You know, they recorded, just in this Race Records series alone, some 2,300 titles, starting with Alberta Hunter, and near the end of their life, with the Mississippi Sheiks and Blind Blake. I just want to make sure I don't leave anybody out. But this was, so they started in 1917, really did nothing to suggest they were long for this world. By 1922, here was their roster. Performers included Louis Armstrong, Jelly Roll Morton, King Oliver, Blind Lemon Jefferson, Ma Rainey, Ethel Waters, Big Bill Brunzi, Coleman Hawkins, Papa Charlie Jackson, Fletcher Henderson, Fats Waller, Alberta Hunter, and Blind Blake. Then, 5 years later, it gets curiouser. They had a second act that threatened to dwarf the first. They birthed the entire recorded genre of Mississippi Delta Blues with Charlie Patton, Son House, Skip James, Tommy Johnson, and Willie Brown. They recorded the Mississippi Sheiks, Tom Dorsey, who was then known as Georgia Tom, Clarence Williams, Ishmael Bracey, Tampa Red, and the immortal Geechee Wiley and L.V. Thomas, who we might hear a little bit more about later. So it's really this, part of the attraction to the tale was just it's you know, we kept calling it the ultimate curious tale, how this label came to be without any interest. They're certainly not to be confused with cultural, you know, they weren't purveyors of culture. It was the most quintessentially American of businesses. They just wanted to turn a buck. And they were able to do that for a short period of time by stumbling upon this market and being able to, among the first to take advantage of it. So when I sat down with Jack, I had this timeline. We had bumped up against Paramount artists like Charlie Patton and others in the past, but seeing them all together arrayed in this by year, just in these columns representing these stacks, these embarrassment of riches, all these artists, it was really astonishing. And that's when Jack and I sat down and looked at this and said, we really should do something more with this. This should be enshrined, you know, this story should be enshrined in some way, this material. You can't go to a museum and interact with this bedrock American art like you can with abstract expressionism, for example. Things that are homegrown, you know, culture here in America, there's no place to go and experience that. And so we really did have the idea of this sort of Wunderkammer or cabinet of curiosities, you know, the precursor to the museum where you would really have this curated experience. And so that was really the idea behind the set, and present it in a way that befits how glorious it is.
And it is beautiful. And I didn't even mention that it has won a Grammy for the best box set. It was a 2014 Grammy as well?
Right.
Yeah, exactly, last year. And so it's a beautiful presentation, and you have all these wonderful recordings, and then you probably were thinking to yourself, God, I wish I knew someone who could tell a story, who could maybe bring these stories alive and put them together for us and maybe write it up. Funny enough, you have a brother who happens to be a writer and was working on See How Small. When you went to him with this project and said, maybe you could help us kind of write up these stories. So Scott, talk about your involvement, and then also, we haven't touched upon this one guy from Brown who played an integral role in bringing all of these artists to the label.
Yeah, well, first of all, I was exceedingly lucky. And, you know, normally, you know, we talked about the jar outside the door that people put donations in. But normally that's the way writers work, is we have our own jar outside the door. And, you know, I was really lucky that Dean had this crazy idea, though at the time, I thought it was a mix of luck and kind of a dare, you know, because I was halfway done with the novel, or about, you know, maybe three-fifths done with the novel, and I was really worried about that novel. And then he came to me and said, oh, I've got this two-year project starting now, and I would love for you to write these stories, you know, basically the narrative of Paramount. And, you know, he said, I know that you don't really know these stories and you don't really know this history that I'm obsessed with, but surely you can learn it, or you can somehow dig into it and find these nuggets, because it is a, you know, it's a curious story, it's a strange story. And I'm not sure, I mean, I said yes before thinking, really carefully about this. And you know, it turns out I was very fortunate, but at the time I was terrified of it. One, because I'd never done a narrative nonfiction book, and he was asking me to do essentially two 125-page books in less than 2 years' time. But what Dean and I had always shared, and I think that allowed me to have confidence in it and excitement beyond my fear, was there was a book some of you may be familiar with called, or maybe not anymore, called Mr. Wilson's Cabinet of Wonder by Lawrence Weschler. It was a National Book Critics Circle Award winner. But what the book is about is essentially what's essential for wonder is not knowing. Not knowing, not having concepts, not having a map, and really invention on the fly, in a sense, and being able to take disparate parts and somehow make a whole out of things in a way that for a reader, a viewer, and you know, someone looking at an object, where it's going to take them out of their everydayness and make it a rarefied experience, one that they have never had before. And you know, fiction writers, that's what they want. They want, it's not to just replicate the world as it is, but to build a world that will take you to a new experience and reverberate in this one. And so that was the challenge. And I think the materials were so rich, as he explained. We were a number of miles away, and I was commuting on the train. But that figured into the story too, the strangeness of the accident of me riding a train. I was commuting from Chicago to Southern Illinois University on Amtrak, which is also the Illinois Central Railroad, which is the Great Migration route from New Orleans all the way to Chicago, which is where many of these artists, they made their way up to Chicago and invented modern jazz and brought the blues to recording for the first time. So there were so many things at play there that I couldn't say no. And of course, 3 years later, I'm really glad I didn't say no. But I was very fortunate to have the opportunity. And I should say too that I did not produce anything in this. This is Dean's vision along combined with Jack's. I wrote, and Dean did a wonderful job in helping me tap into the vision. And I think a collaborative project like this takes so much energy and so much creative, electricity, and across boundaries. I think close to 40 people worked on each of these at any given time. So I was fortunate. You know, I would write something and send it to Dean, and he would send it to an artist in New York, Katie Deedy, and she would riff on that. And it was a truly collaborative experience that I feel lucky to be a part of. You asked about Mayo Williams, this figure from Brown. Now, this may be the person that caught our attention early on as maybe the central figure in the whole story. Do you want me to?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So Mayo Williams, graduate, African American graduate of Brown University. I believe he graduated in 1914. He's this truly amazing figure. He went to work for he was a part of the Hammond, Indiana. NFL team, early NFL. He was a gin runner on the south side of Chicago. He was involved in Black Swan Records in New York, and he had this vague kind of responsibility there. And he was in and around Chicago kind of collecting money, it sounded like, collecting on subscriptions, it sounded like, for this record label. So he didn't really have any experience in the record industry, except, you know, he knew people. He was good friends with Paul Robeson, who he also played NFL ball with. Of course, it goes without saying. And he, you know, he kind of stumbled into a situation. He had heard that, and this is in 1923, he had heard that Paramount was struggling, which they were mightily at this point, and likely would have gone out of business. But he decided, in between his gin running on the South Side and various other entrepreneurial experiences, that he would go up to Grafton, Wisconsin, where the chair factory was and where Paramount's headquarters were. And he would make a cold call on the owners. And you can imagine what this, you know, you can, it's kind of hard to imagine, but imagine what Grafton, Wisconsin is like, you know, in 1923. It's all white with some Czech immigrants and German immigrants, Scandinavian, but all white. This, you know, very nattily dressed, beautiful black man, athletic, comes in unannounced and goes up, pitches himself as the person who has all the connections in Chicago to make things happen. He knows Ma Rainey. He knows Alberta Hunter. He knows all the great figures that are playing at the Dreamland Ballroom in Chicago on the South Side, and he can make things happen. You know, he has experience with, he knows Jelly Roll Morton. You know, he knows all the people that will make it happen. The way the story goes is he came through town, through Grafton, and little boys, white boys, followed him through town because they'd never seen a figure like this, you know, dressed to the nines. And, you know, he was kind of a legendary figure. And he pitched himself as essentially the savior of Paramount. And strangely enough, he was. He became the person that he imagined himself to be. And pretty soon changed all of Paramount's fortunes by connecting the dots in and around the great black metropolis on the South Side. Otherwise, I mean, these guys were recording, you know, Czech bands, Oompa bands. They were just throwing stuff at the wall to see what would happen. They knew no black artists at all. And so Mayo Williams is a central figure. You know, he becomes the engine that drives this massive collecting, essentially, of all these great artists, even some people who play their nose.
That's right. Everything was equal under the law of Paramount, because they had no idea, again, what would sell, what was legitimate, what wasn't, and we're glad they didn't. But that really was, you know, he was a key figure. That's one of the stories we wanted to tell, was Mayo Williams' pivotal role in the launching of all this incredible music. It's interesting to think, you know, without him and without Paramount, how much of this, not just artists, these artists that would have gone unrecorded, but whole traditions. You got to remember in 1920s, the Library of Congress hasn't started their field recording operations. And absent someone with virtually no filter on the recording operations, you're not going to capture a lot of these sounds that were being made, which themselves were already last gasps, you know, dating back before the turn of the century. And so without someone there who really wasn't filtering this for commerciality until the 30s, well, by the 30s, a lot of these traditions were dead. And so what you hear represented are not just artists from whom little else was heard and got heard, you know, solely because of Paramount, but whole traditions, you know, the hints at things that went unrecorded. And that's one of the other narratives that ran through this narrative threads, was around this kind of lost universe that we wanted to make sure we captured. It's great to capture the early performances of Louis Armstrong and Jelly Roll Morton and King Oliver and these other figures, but equally great is this body of other recordings that are just transcendent. And it would be great as part of celebrating this music to maybe play a track. I don't know if you're ready.
Could I add one thing about Mayo Williams that I forgot? His whole, and it ties into the whole story, his whole intention, Mayo Williams' whole intention by getting with Paramount was to go after black opera. That's what he wanted. He didn't even care that much about that music. So again, his intention is completely other, but he ends up gathering this. He, Cicerita Jones, he was, you know, a huge fan of an early black opera singer, and that's what he wanted to recreate because he thought that was the culture that should be aspired to. So
exactly. You know, and definitely, I think now is a great time to hear something, but I wanted to mention, how many of you have read Scott's writings about the rise and fall of Paramount Records? Tommy, besides you. But, you know, I'm kicking myself for not having you bring some of them. Did you bring any? The writings are so beautiful, and they really set this scene of, you know, even just the train rides and the way that these musicians were imagining what they would be by recording their music. And one more thing I'd just like to touch upon before we hear something is that you're going to hear in these recordings, they're not good recordings. As we mentioned, they were recording on clay and, you know, all these very strange materials, and Paramount Records didn't really care about the quality of the recordings as much. So imagine Apple, and they're like, well, we need something to fill iTunes. So, like, whatever you got, just put it on iTunes, basically. You know, this is a vehicle for distributing music. But I think it's really fascinating. We'll talk a little bit about how we associate these types of recordings with an authentic sound of the past and an authentic remembering of these voices. So what are we going to hear first, Dean?
Maestro, if you can cue up track number 3. And play that, and then we'll talk about it afterwards. Thanks.
So
So that was a guy named Jimmy O'Brien and his famous original washboard band. He was considered sort of the poor man's Johnny Dodds of his day, billed himself as the clarinet wizard. He had played in the bands, the combined bands of Jelly Roll Morton and W.C. Handy in the early 20s, played in King Oliver's band. But what you hear there is him, something quite different from what you would have heard him doing in those bands, something which sounds very much like his own thing. He recorded that in 1925. He was dead by 1928. He made 25 recordings under his own leadership with his band, and that's all he did is what is there on Paramount. So it's the name of the piece is My Man Rocks Me. So that's one of the one of the aspects of this story that was really important to tell was some of these lost figures. You know, he's not really written into mainstream jazz history despite his pedigree, and maybe it's because he made strange music. That music is a little bit strange to the ear. Certainly doesn't fit into the jazz canon of the 1920s. It sounds like something where he picked up on, you know, tricks learned in the vaudeville tent, among other places, and came out with this sort of slithery music. But all of his music has that character, and absent Paramount, does, again, not knowing that it wasn't worth recording, happened to record it, and so here it is.
Exactly. And, you know, as you were walking in, we were playing a lot of the pieces, and we debated about whether or not we should have them because it kind of seems like it's wallpaper and, you know, it's like, is anybody really going to get it? We should really focus in on a couple of them. But I think how interesting it is to think about how these pieces are so quickly wallpaper, how we associate a mythology to them very quickly without really knowing the stories behind them. And Scott, a lot of your work is about these lost voices, about, you know, giving voice to these people, like in See How Small, the girls in the yogurt shop murders, or in the yogurt shop, yeah, murders, I guess it was, whose voices were taken away from them so quickly. And all of these voices from Paramount Records, these are also kind of these ghosts that you're giving voice to. Can you talk a little bit about a couple specific stories of Gishy Wiley and Ellie Thomas and why understanding who they were and where they were from is so important?
Well, and Dean was actually present for some of the new discoveries about them, so we'll let him talk about that. But they, I think part of, you know, earlier we were talking about not knowing as this kind of generative thing, and a lot was, or very little was actually known about them. They were thought to be, Gishy Wiley and L.V. Thomas were supposed to be from the Mississippi Delta. And there's only, what, six recordings they ever made. And they were made at in Grafton. Then essentially whisked away, never to be heard from again. And the historical record was almost nil. There were a lot of rumors, a lot of conjecture. And, you know, it's always, you always get a lot of reliable information by interviewing people like 55 years later, about what, you know, where they were from and what they did. And, you know, everyone also, as they gained a little more notoriety among collectors, you know, everyone kind of likely embellished, I'm just thinking, to increase also their own notoriety. And so it just deepened the mystery. They did duets together. And I guess Gishy did most of the singing on them, but there's at least two. Am I right with that? About that? With
Elvis? I think they both play guitar and sing at least on some of the tracks.
Harmony,
that they sing.
Yeah. It's hard to really capture. I mean, Dean a little while ago was talking about the whole idea of, that no one had categories for this music, and it was coming out of traditions that now are lost entirely, like 19th century traditions. And that were small to begin with, maybe and fragmented, and culturally specific, and So these are just intimations, really, of a larger culture that was out there that'll never be recorded, never found, even in the remnants are gone. So I think that's one reason why we just had little pieces to go on. And their music is so evocative, and it clearly participates in some other realm. I mean, it's not country blues, it's not blues, it's not folk music in the traditional sense. It has elements to it that are draw you in and repel you. Minor E chords that send a shiver down your spine, and you're not really sure what's happening to you. And I think that's one reason why people respond so strongly to the music. Should we listen?
Yeah, one of the interesting things about Geechee and Elvie is, of course, it was their otherness that must have meant they were from Mississippi, because everything that's transcendent in the blues must have emanated from the Delta somehow. And so that was really those were really the facts that went into having them sourced as being from Mississippi.
That's the map, like Rebecca was talking.
Right, that's the mapping that people project onto these folks, because they are so cipher-like. You have to project something onto them, because they're really, the form of music that they play is unrecognizable to us now. It's not a blues in the way that we think of it. And the thought is that it represents traditions, again, that predated what a blues might have sounded like in the late 1800s. If someone were to have played it, and that they're just the sort of tip of the iceberg. Paramount gives us these glimmers into these traditions that were just then, in their sort of last gasp phases. And so with that, why don't we listen to one of them, and then we can talk a little bit more about them. If you can cue up number 12, this is Elvie Thomas on lead with Geechee Wiley. On the track is called Motherless Child Blues.
Do you remember the day, baby, you drove me from your door?
So that was L.V. Thomas on lead guitar and vocal with Geechee Wiley on backup vocals and guitar. It's called Motherless Child Blues. It was recorded in 1930. As Scott mentioned, one of the six tracks that they collectively recorded, never to be heard from again until recently. It was determined they weren't, in fact, from Mississippi. They were from Houston, black settlements dotted around Houston. And we have the legendary folklorist and researcher Mac McCormick, who's still living in Houston in his late 80s now. He had actually interviewed L.V. Thomas, it turns out, in 1961, but never told anyone. So.
And he hoarded the information and kept it from all researchers. Uh-huh.
Yeah, despite being asked about it many times.
And it makes me think, too, you know, as we're listening to these, we're also looking at these images, and there's this beautiful artwork. We have no idea who drew these pictures and who did all of the artwork on the covers of the albums or anything.
Right. I mean, that, if you've seen the art pass by here, get a chance to look at it, it looks somewhat familiar if you're conversant in Robert Crumb's work, just because he has acknowledged this as the charitably the key resource for his style. But I think he also said basically he ripped off the style in these ads for his cross-hatching
And he was a collector.
Artwork.
He's a big collector of these albums.
Yeah, it comes from a genuine place of love. His stealing, it really does. No, but he is a pretty legendary collector of the music himself. If you saw the documentary Crumb that came out some years ago, one of Geechee Wiley's tracks was featured in the documentary and this is one of his treasured records, and as it should be, as it's one of a few known copies to exist. But it's a record that you see him playing and just sort of descending into a trance to. But that's where it. If you've heard of Geechee Wiley, a lot of it pivoted off of that, or exposure from that movie.
And a lot of this is lost because there was just no viable market. You know, they were thinking, well, there's no market, and which makes me think if things weren't a commodity, then they didn't really exist. You know, and you wonder what has been lost because things are not commodifiable.
Yeah, they certainly they were only interested in what they could sell this week. They had no, you know, they didn't have a mission as a, you know, preservationist. You know, far from it. It was a waste of warehouse space to them after it ceased having a useful sales life. And so, and of course, at this time, the only master recordings, this was pre-tape, so the master recordings were made. Or essentially made at the time of recording, they would make a wax copy of a record and then essentially create a reverse mold of that out of metal. And then that would be pressed into this very poor quality shellac compound, if you're talking about Paramount. So they ensured the obsolescence of these in terms of their physical materials, because even by the standards of the day, these were really poor quality records. So you get some sense of their lack of investment in this as a cultural artifact. You know, this was a widget. They could have been selling anything. They could have been selling a chair, a cushion, a pillow, or it happened to be a record that had all this magical stuff encoded in its grooves. And all we have in terms of master recordings are the surviving records themselves. So we go to Robert Crumb and say, can we borrow your record so that we can put Geechee Wiley, make her part of this collection? And those are really your only, that's really your only resort if you want to traffic in these recordings.
And we're going to open things up to questions in just a minute, but before we do, a lot of these records were made out of clay, and they returned to perhaps the river clay that they were made from. How did that happen?
When Paramount ceased production in 1932. They do what any self-respecting company would do, and you'd hold a Christmas party for your employees, you know, for the send-off, and fire them all at the Christmas party. This is just how they rolled, and you know, you can imagine the reaction, which I think on at this Christmas party, everyone might have been drinking. I'm just guessing. And so they went downstairs as a mob and grabbed armfuls of Paramount records in the storage areas. Armfuls, you know, dozens and dozens and dozens of people, including the masters, the metal masters. And they took them up on the roof of this, I don't know, 10-story building there in Grafton, the manufacturing facility, went up to the roof and had great fun, great joy in tossing them off the roof into the Milwaukee River one by one until they were all, you know, crushed on the ground or in the river. And that was a fun night for me.
Yeah, some years back there was a, you may have seen, there was an episode of the History Detectives. I don't know what channel that's on for you enthusiasts, but there was an episode where they actually went and had divers go in the Milwaukee River near the site of the factory to see if they could uncover some of the masters. It was about as exciting as the Geraldo special, from what I understand.
Well, let's open things up to questions for a few minutes. Jack has a microphone right over there. Just raise your hand.
So if those masters were destroyed, how did the masters come about to create this project?
Yeah, that's solely through the generosity of the collecting community. People actually have the issued record. And in some cases, there are, you know, very literally one, you know, copy of a record that's known to exist. And so you navigate that community carefully. And if you've seen the movie Ghost World, that's a pretty accurate depiction of the 78 collecting community. So it you build in a couple of years into your timeline for putting these projects together just to make your way through. Yeah.
And how did you play them and record them? How did you record this?
Well, we've had since really the early days of the label, we've developed these, you know, because I don't, you know, the label doesn't have any employees or staff. You know, these projects are sort of intermittent. As the urge strikes, and so I would assemble a team for each project. But there's been some, members that have been common to virtually all the projects, including this guy Chris King, who's himself a collector, but he's also a bit of a sonic wizard. It's a little bit of art and a little bit of science to eke out the sound that's encoded in these grooves, which has been, you know, again, this is the poorest materials, you know, that were used in the industry. It's also been, most of these records have been played to death, so their surface is literally gray because you can barely see the grooves, and so it takes a bit of a mad scientist to find ways to eke out sound that's embedded in the walls of those grooves, including, you know, trial and error, playing a turntable that's used for the transfers at an angle, so maybe the needle will settle into more on one side of a groove than the other, and there may be more sound found to be found in that wall, that groove wall. So you develop trusted, you know, relationships with these different folks over a period of 20 years, and you know that if it can be done, they have the best shot at doing it.
Another question?
A lot of these posters have the popular race record down below. Is that a marketing technique for something?
Right, so the race records just referred to the entire industry of black performers that were intended for black audiences. And so there were a number of labels, OK and Columbia, Victor, a lot of other competing labels also had their own race records catalog. Paramount was the race records juggernaut during this period, though. They had the, you know, they sold, if you know, just in Blind Lemon Jefferson, Ma Rainey, and Blind Blake records alone, they sold, you know, hundreds of thousands of records during this period. So they were, in fact, the popular race record.
Another question?
Did you have access to, what kind of archival resources did you have access to, like business records or libraries, or were you dependent on kind of the collector community and existing discographies?
Yeah, that was also almost wholly resourced from the collector community. There really isn't a lot, even in the Ozaukee County Historical Society in Wisconsin. I mean, they were helpful where they could be, but there is no central archive. There's no, again, no master recordings. There's no Paramount doesn't, you know, there's no inheritor to the Paramount assets, really, as they, you know, there's really nothing much left today. And so even for the ephemera, the print materials that you see reproduced here, and the ads, you know, we literally had to go back, and Susan Archie, who's an Atlanta designer that I've worked with for a long time, literally went back through. Those all come from the Chicago Defender, which was the, you know, the black audience newspaper, leading black audience newspaper of the day, huge circulation. And every week from 1922 to 1930, Paramount would run an ad, one of these hand-illustrated ads. And Susan actually went back through, because there were, these had been reproduced. You'd seen them, of course, Robert Crumb had seen them and committed them to heart and memory, but they hadn't been reproduced well in many cases. And so she actually went back to the microfilm versions of the Chicago Defender and was able to tease out all the best versions of the ads. So that's an example of the kind of, you know, painstaking effort that went into most of this stuff, just because there is no central repository for any of it.
And just briefly, for those unfamiliar with the Chicago Defender, it was the source of news for African Americans. It was distributed on the Illinois Central by Pullman porters all over the South, along with records. They took records, Paramount records, all over the South, and at every stop they would be selling them. And the news of the day was transmitted through the Chicago Defender, so it was the largest black paper in the country, and it had everything in it.
Yeah, interestingly, that was, you know, one of Paramount's unconventional distribution channels was through the Pullman porters on the trains, because they didn't have access to the distribution networks that a major company, you know, a Columbia or a Victor had, and so they had to rely on unconventional channels to get the records out to people. You know, they actually were the first company to have a mail order record business. This is pre, what was it, Columbia Record Club, that you did not pay for your CDs. I know you didn't.
You dropped your membership.
Yeah,
you dropped
your membership. This was many years before that. And so they were the first to utilize that, the first to utilize the trains as distribution method. And they also used, they cultivated relationships with these sort of hot spots in various cities, in Atlanta or in Birmingham or these other cities that had sizable black populations, where they could draw on local scouts. These were record store owners, music store owners, people who were selling furniture and pianos, but also were connected to the community. And that's how you discovered Blind Lemon Jefferson, not because you were riding through Texas and just happened to pull over to the side of the road. You had cultivated a relationship with a local entrepreneur who had a shop, who said, hey, you should come down to Deep Ellum and check this guy out. He's drawing a huge crowd at lunch every day. The cars can't get by. We had to get him to move a quarter mile off the road. And, you know, these were all the things they had to resort to because they had no other choice. And it turned out to be the secret to their success.
Another question?
So the man you said was in Houston in his 80s, did he talk to you about the recordings he made or anything? And, you know, I don't know why he didn't share those, because now he could have been included in this, couldn't he?
Wait a second. I'm supposed to answer this? Yeah, it's a great point. It's hard to know why somebody would sit on information, especially when they've probably gotten a number of inquiries about it over the years. So it's really hard to say. This man is, Mac McCormick, has done incredible research and written some really incredible and mostly unpublished books, unfortunately. So he has a wealth of information to offer to the canon of what's known about folk music including blues. And I hope one day he'll want to share all that information with the world. Right now, he's been unwilling or unable to do that. So this was just a limited window into one artist or two artists.
One more question.
Hey, Dean. Just wondering, you were pretty much bound to ask these people to give up their crown jewels for your effort. Do you have any one particular story of a notable conquest and someone who might have been particularly resistant to give it up or actually going about getting the material?
It's tricky because, of course, no one wants to send you their one-of-a-kind record so that you can make your digital transfer of it in, you know, the perfect recording setup. At best, you're going to get to visit them on their terms and make transfers. And so that did limit, to some degree, the quality of the... I mean, you're already pretty limited by the source material, by its degradation over time, the way it was recorded even, because again, Paramount was about cheapness. Even in the recording, they didn't even have their own recording studio until very late in the game, 1929, when they were out of business by 32 and had been in business for 12 years by that point. So they relied on, you know, these kind of contractors to do their work for them. So you're up against that, and then you add in not being able to maybe eke out as much sound from the recording itself. It can be very frustrating. There's a lot of stories from this community. Some of the Skip James recordings, which it'd be nice to play one of those, just because if people are probably somewhat familiar with them, if they know anything about Paramount or country blues, but if you're not, it's one to hear, just because he's such a phenomenal performer, and a large body of recordings that were recorded. One thing we didn't have access to that really frustrated me was there. Despite what we said about all the masters being lost, there are actually metal masters for some of Skip James's recordings that were, we never could determine where they were. They had been in, was it in University of Wisconsin's archives? Where did you go and check and then had it made its way?
University of Chicago?
Oh, in University of Chicago, yeah. That's right. There's a man named John Steiner who was a record label owner in the 40s who had used some of this material. At the time of his death, all his possessions had gone to University of Chicago, but curiously, some of these Skip James masters had walked off, and there were empty envelopes.
I mean, and they have everything in these archives. They have like his matchbook covers and everything.
And yet, but they don't have these metal masters. So no. that was a holy grail that got away, I guess.
Well, these beautiful artifacts are still available on Amazon, right?
They are available on Amazon. The best way to buy them is to go to Third Man Records. That's Jack White's record label in Nashville, and I think it's the cheapest way to obtain them. And they are
really incredible. And you get all of the writings. You get over 1,600 recordings, and albums, and also a USB drive, right. So you can have all of the
material
digital.
That you see up here is included on the little app on the USB drive. Very simple interface, I assure you. Won't baffle anybody. And then a lot of the most graphically rich of the ads are reproduced in large format, in print form, as part of these large books that we have in here as well. So it's intended to be an immersive experience, yeah.
I was going to have you read something from that, and yeah. You totally forgot. But it's okay. We'll leave people hanging.
Yes.
That's right.
And just to note that Scott is one of two novelists who have ever been nominated for a Grammy. The other was my mentor.
Your mentor, yes.
Frank Conroy.
From
the University of Iowa. So it's good to know you both.
But he won.
But you know, before
but
we go...
this is this year.
I should have met you sooner.
Yeah, I know, the luck. It's already rubbing off on him.
Before we go out, let's hear one more piece. And also before we go out, I would really like to thank you, not only for all of the work that you've done to put this together and make this available for everybody, but thank you for coming out tonight. This is wonderful.
Thank you, Rebecca, for
Thanks,
hosting.
Rebecca.
Wonderful.
Thanks
for coming out, guys.
Coming.
So one more piece. What are we going to go out on?
Let's listen to... the immortal Skip James, I'm So Glad. This thing is off the charts from a performance standpoint, from a technical standpoint, from a ecstaticism standpoint. He's definitely channeling something ecstatic. We're not sure if it's the cloven hoof or the furious beating of angels' wings or what exactly, but
it's definitely other.
It's definitely other.
I'm so glad, and I am glad. I don't know what to do. I'm tired of weeping, tired of moaning, tired of groaning for you. And I'm so glad, I am glad. I'm tired of weeping, tired of mourning, tired of groaning for you. And I'm so glad, and I am glad. I'm so tired of mourning, tired of groaning, tired of longing for you. I'm so glad, I am glad. I don't know what to do, I don't know what to do. I'm so tired, and I am tired. I am glad. I don't know what to do. I'm tired of weeping, tired of mourning, tired of groaning for you. And I'm so glad. I am glad. I'm so tired, I am tired. I'm tired of weeping, tired of mourning, tired of groaning for you. I'm so glad, I am glad. I don't know what to do.
Well, thank you again. Thank you everyone for coming out. Our next Views and Brews is November 10th, and it will be on jazz and the connection between jazz and psychoanalysis. So hopefully you can come out for that one. On November 10th. And thank you for coming out tonight. Stick around and check this wonderful stuff out and have a beautiful evening. Thank you.
You've been listening to A Views and Brews, recorded live at the Cactus Cafe in Austin, Texas, for KUT Radio. You'll find a complete archive of all of our Views and Brews in the iTunes store or go to KUT.org for more information. Thanks for listening.